The meeting is being called to order. Welcome to the meeting of the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee. Ms. Hannon, would you please call the roll?
Trustee Rita Athus?
Here.
Trustee Dennis Barsima?
Here.
Committee Vice Chair John Butler?
Here.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Here.
Trustee Veronica Herrero? Trustee Tim Moore?
Here.
Trustee Leland Strom?
Here.
Trustee Eric Wazowitz?
Here.
Mr. Perry, would you please verify that we have a quorum and that the appropriate notice of the meeting has been posted?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. You have a quorum present. An appropriate notice has been provided pursuant to the Illinois Open Meetings Act.
Thank you. Thank you. May I have a motion to approve the agenda for today's meeting?
So moved, Barsima.
Is there a second?
Second, Barsima.
Any discussion? All in favor of adopting the agenda as specified, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Any abstentions? Motion carries. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of the meeting of November 9th, 2023?
So moved, Wazowitz.
Is there a second?
Second, Moore.
Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor of the approval of the minutes of November 9th, 2023, indicate by saying aye.
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 Any abstentions? Any opposed? Motion carries. I'd like to welcome everyone here today to our February meeting of the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs. For some reason, I felt that that was in March.
Yeah. It feels like that? March.
Yeah. When I saw February, forgive me. And Personnel Committee meeting. The semester is fully underway, and I want to report some great news about the success of our students and progress on University Goal 2A. This spring's 10-day enrollment count is the largest fall to spring enrollment rate for all undergraduates in 6 years, and second highest rate in a decade. This success is a great example of what can happen when people come together around shared leadership, responsibility, and accountability. Units across campus in Student Affairs, Academic Affairs, ADEI, and colleges and others worked together to meet students where they were and offered support that addressed each student's individual needs. We are truly putting students at the center of what we do at NIU. Today, we have 5 items for approval and 3 informational items. We will consider 3 curricular changes. First, the deletion of the Masters of Science in Education and Educational Psychology. Second, a request to delete the minor in Social Change Leadership. Third, a request to approve a new minor in Health Administration. And fourth, the fourth item, is approval of a faculty tenure and promotion request. Dr. Anur Kandir will be joining NIU as the Director of Burma Studies. We will consider an appointment for Dr. Kandir as a professor with tenure in the Department of History. The fifth item for approval is faculty and professional staff sabbatical request. As you all know, sabbaticals are a critical component of academic excellence and provide our faculty with time to renew and strengthen their scholarship, artistry, and teaching. We will also have a chance to hear from Dr. Natalie Churick about how her sabbatical enhanced her scholarship and outreach. We also have the annual report of the outcomes of sabbatical leaves that were completed during the 2020 and 2021 academic year, and a presentation by Dr. Carol Sumner and Dr. Clint Michael Renew on NIU as an emerging Hispanic serving institution. Before we go into the agenda, I want to welcome any University Advisory Committee representatives present today. The current UAC representatives are Felicia Bohannon, Ben Creed, Brad Kripe, Larissa Garcia, Natasha Johnson, and Karen Wedby. Do any of you have any comments for the board? Thank you, welcome though. Mr. Perry, have any members of the public registered written requests to address the board in accordance with state law and Board of Trustees bylaws?
Mr. Chair, you had no public comment this morning.
Before we proceed though further with our agenda, I'd like to recognize Trustee Wazowitz.
Thank you, Trustee Gales. I know this is our first committee meeting of the year, but we have something very special happening here this week. And we have a birthday of one of our trustees who's going to be hitting a milestone birthday, I believe.
And I too know this trustee.
I think you do know this trustee. And I thought it might be a really great idea if we sang happy birthday to Trustee Barsema for his 70th birthday.
Well, let me
you
ask...
You had to say that, didn't you?
Before we go further, though, is this going to be the traditional birthday or is this the Stevie Wonder birthday? Let's do the traditional.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Dennis. Happy birthday to you.
And many more.
And can I just say...
I will get you.
And there were a few people pulling some strings behind me, one of them being your wife, by the way. But
I will get her back.
Okay.
Very good, very good. But we do that out of affection and love for you, Dennis. So at this time, I'd like to invite Interim Executive Vice President Provost Lori Illich Piper to present the university recommendations.
Thank you, Trustee Gales. I, too, am very pleased with our progress on student retention and success. As noted, we have five action items today. Item 7A, the university proposes to delete the Master of Science in Education and Educational Psychology offered by the Department of Leadership, Educational Psychology, and Foundations in the College of Education. Due to low enrollment for numerous years and the subsequent inability for courses to meet minimum enrollment criteria, the faculty and the program, along with the chair of the department, have collectively decided to discontinue offering the Master of Science in Educational Psychology. Accommodations will be made for the remaining one student in the program. Faculty are committed to ensuring that that student can successfully complete their program of study. The university recommends that the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request and asks that the president forward it by means of the president's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its meeting on March 21st, 2024. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Anyone have any questions?
It says in here that there's one remaining student and that student will be accommodated through. What stage in the program is that student in?
They're just completing their coursework. They're near the end of the program. Okay. So they'll be able to take their final courses and meet the graduation requirements.
Thank you.
Any others? Seeing no other questions, may I have a motion to approve item 7A, requests for deletion of the Master of Science in Education and Educational Psychology.
So moved, Barsema.
Is there a second?
Second, Athos.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, let's call the question. All those in favor of the deletion, please indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? Any abstentions? Motion carries.
Next, item 7B. The university proposes to delete the minor in social change leadership offered by the Department of Counseling and Higher Education in the College of Education. The minor has had minimal enrollment and/or interest for several years. Students currently enrolled in the minor will be able to complete the minor as the department will continue to offer the required courses as they fulfill the general education requirements, specifically Social Change Leadership 100 and Social Change Leadership 200. The university recommends that the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request and asks that the president forward it by means of the president's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its meeting on March 21st, 2024.
Again, I ask my colleagues, do you have any questions or discussion around this issue? Hearing none, may I have a motion to approve item 7B, request for the deletion of the minor in social change leadership.
So made, Strum.
Second? Is there a second?
Second, Wazowitz.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carries. Please continue.
Thank you. Item 7C. The university proposes to offer a new minor in health administration in the School of Health Studies within the College of Health and Human Sciences. The minor in health administration is directed toward undergraduate students across campus and within the College of Health and Human Sciences who seek to understand the business side of public health and healthcare. The BS in Public Health with a Health Administration emphasis is the college's most popular emphasis, and the proposed minor will continue to attract students to this discipline. Health administration is a dynamic field given the constant changes in healthcare, and it complements a variety of majors across the university. Particularly, students in the College of Business, Engineering and Engineering Technology, and Liberal Arts and Sciences are premier candidates for the proposed minor. For example, in the College of Engineering and Engineering Technology, the students in Industrial and Systems Engineering and Engineering Technology the students in Industrial and Systems Engineering and Engineering Technology have a Health Systems Engineering emphasis, where public health administration courses are already part of that curriculum. Those students could complete this proposed minor with as few as 3 additional courses. The university recommends that the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request and asks that the President forward it by means of the President's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its meeting on March 21st, 2024.
Thank you. Thank you. Again, is there any discussion around this issue? And just so the public knows, these issues are not just popping up and we're surprised. We've heard about these issues, and many of us have asked questions in the past, but I just wanted to see if there are any other questions of today's hearing. Any other questions? Yes, Trustee Matt.
I don't have a comment, just a question, a comment. I was really pleased to see this with the emphasis on health administration and the fact that it's going to be, again, cross-departmental. You're going to be able to, I think we've talked about this. I think this is a very progressive way for the university to move forward. So very pleased with this change.
Okay. If I have no...
I do. Do you want me to hold it until after we do a motion and a second?
We can do that.
Okay.
So with that said, may I have a motion to approve item 7C, request for new minor in health administration?
So moved, Appis.
Second, Wasowitz.
Very good. We've got a second. Now we have open for discussion.
Thank you.
Please.
Yeah, thank you. So I noticed in the write-up that we were projecting that students from the College of Business, from College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and I think there was one other, might have an interest in this minor. As I read about the minor and what it's going to provide, it was my inclination that there would be courses that might be offered in other colleges that would be pertinent to this minor relative to business courses and such. So is there any working across the colleges relative to coursework for this, in addition to potential students coming from other colleges, or is all of the coursework 100% contained in the College of Health and Human Sciences?
I'll speak generally, and then I'll call Dr. Jean Isabel to the podium to answer more specifically. But any sort of new curricular proposal goes through a process where all of the colleges are involved. So there's opportunity to offer input, opportunity to give feedback. And so we really promote that transdisciplinary and cross-college collaboration when we're introducing anything new to make sure that we're looking at the appropriate linkages and opportunities. But specifically related to the curriculum, I'll hand it over to Jean.
Thank you very much for the question. Currently, the courses are in the Public Health Department, but we are certainly open to working with other colleges if we need substitutions or something of that sort.
Can you touch on the collaboration that goes into the deletion of a course?
The same process takes place through our curricular structure, that if courses are deleted, there's approval not only at the department and the college level, but also at the university level, and where those representatives come from all of the colleges. So there's an opportunity to offer input, to ask questions, to review data before those decisions are made through voting.
Very good. Thank you.
Can I offer a comment follow up on that? I just want to really commend Interim Executive Vice President and Provost Dr. Alice Piper for the lens that she has added to those conversations that go on with cross-college consideration of courses. I think it's no secret to anyone here, we're looking for ways to be more efficient and to give our students more options to finish their degrees quickly. And whereas historically, sometimes those conversations were more a check of, is any turf being stepped on, or the conversations now, and Dr. Elish Piper has really promoted this, are about efficiencies from the standpoint of, will expanding courses that can be considered as options help students finish more quickly? And also, do we all need to offer the same course, or can we reduce curricular complexity and cost to the university in a way that's not very painful or impactful for our students but still saves us money? So she has been a leading voice in having those conversations. We already had the structures in place for them to occur within. Faculty have been very responsive, and I really commend Dr. Elish Piper and our faculty who've been engaged in those conversations.
Yes,
ma'am. My question was a bit along the same line, because it said, and again, as the new trustee, this will be helpful for so I understand. Under the funding, it says no additional resources are not required to support the new minor, which, again, I assume there's no new faculty. What other pieces go into this analysis of the funding piece of a new program? I realize we just eliminated two prior to this one. Now we're adding a program here.
Right. And this particular minor is moving with existing courses, mm-hmm. and packaging them up in a way that then gives students this minor, this credential that'll be transcripted, mm-hmm. So they have documentation of that. So it's really just reorganizing and deploying our resources in a different way without having to add additional costs. Like you said, no new faculty in this case, not adding any new courses.
Yeah. Okay.
Very good. And President Freeman, before we move on, I want to echo your compliments of the provost. She's done a great job, and we do appreciate what she brings to the table. Any other discussion? Hearing none, we've got a motion on the table. All those in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries. Provost Elish Piper, will you please read 7D?
Yes. 7D. Item 7D is the recommendation for faculty tenure and promotion effective 2023-24. Dr. Aurore Candier is joining NIU as the Director of Burma Studies with the rank of professor with tenure in the Department of History in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. She is a historian of intellectual, political, and cultural history of Burma and Burmese society. The university recommends that the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request, and that the President forward it by means of the President's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its meeting on March 21st, 2024.
Any discussion on this item? Can I get a motion to approve?
So moved, Wasowitz.
Second, Athus.
I have a motion, a second. Is there any discussion? All those in favor of the motion, please indicate by saying, may I have a voice vote?
Roll call vote. Trustee Rita Athus?
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Persima?
Yes.
Committee Vice Chair John Butler?
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales?
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrero? Trustee Tim Moore?
I abstain.
Trustee Leland Strom?
Aye.
Trustee Eric Wasowitz.
Yes.
All right, the motion carries.
All right. Item 7E is the recommendation for faculty and supportive professional staff sabbaticals for the 2024-25 academic year. We are seeking approval for 34 sabbaticals and 12 alternates. The university recommends that the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee endorse this request and asks that the President forward it by means of the President's report to the Board of Trustees for approval at its meeting on March 21st, 2024.
Before we get a motion on this, I just wanted to point out that Trustee Moore does not need to abstain on sabbaticals. May I have a motion to approve the motion? The item 78.
So moved, Butler.
Is there a second?
Second, Wasowitz.
We have a motion, a second. Is there any further discussion on the matter?
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes. Trustee Barsima.
So in the write-up, there were, I think, three criteria to the sabbatical being granted, the capacity of the person to do work, the stature of the work, if you will, or the quality of the work that they plan to do. And I think there was a third one that's escaping me right now. But So is there a, what are the criteria goes into somebody being eligible for a sabbatical? Is there a time period that they have to, you know, be in their position? Can you talk a little bit about the process?
Yes, there is a time horizon when individuals are eligible for sabbaticals. And so once they are eligible, they can put forward a proposal. Those proposals are reviewed at the department level, they're reviewed at the college level, and then they come forth to the university for review. And when those are being reviewed at the department level, they are also looking at the capacity of the department to be able to cover operations and courses while the person would be on sabbatical. So that's the other variable that's considered, making sure that we have the appropriate resources to support that sabbatical. And so it is a competitive process. And as you can see, there were a number of alternates and others that were not selected for the sabbatical. So it is a competitive process, and we want to make sure that we're selecting folks who, as you said, have the capacity to do really impactful work, and that the departments are able to continue their operations during that sabbatical to make sure that courses are offered and so on.
So is it typical for the professor, you know, whatever rank they are, to bring forward the request for sabbatical, or will the department go to them?
Yeah, the individual puts forth a proposal. Once they're eligible, they've served in the role or are eligible because it's been a certain number of years since they had their last sabbatical and they're eligible, the individual faculty puts together their sabbatical proposal. Oftentimes they'll do that in consultation with others in the department. So for example, knowing that three or four people might want to put forth sabbatical proposals, talking about sort of the timing of what makes sense to do that, but the individual puts together the proposal that aligns with the specific work that they propose to do during their sabbatical. Oftentimes that work is directly focused on their research, on their artistry, on some aspect of scholarship, although it generally also informs their teaching and their outreach and their you know, their work with students. But the individual faculty are the ones who develop the proposal and put it forth.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is there an appeal process if I was denied my sabbatical and I thought I provided all the good reasons why I should be getting one? Is there an appeal process?
That's an interesting question. So at the very local level, sometimes departments will give feedback to individuals, and they can use that feedback if they want to then submit in a subsequent year. But you know, it isn't really a formal sort of appeal process in that regard. But they do have the opportunity to revise it and to submit it again the next year for consideration.
Any other questions? Any comments?
Yeah, just a quick. In reading through the report, it used an analysis of the 2020-2021 year, mm-hmm. where there were 37 mm-hmm. sabbaticals awarded. 13 of them went unused. Mm-hmm. Is that typical percentage? That's a third of them.
I think that was unusual because of COVID, and a lot of the proposals required that people be able to travel or to do work out in the field to collect research data or collaborate with other individuals, and so because of COVID, a lot of folks had to not accept the sabbatical approval because they simply could not carry out the work that they had proposed to do.
So you don't expect that type mm-hmm. of decline percentage with
no.
this current
budget. No, we do not.
Okay.
Typically, in the history of the university, the 13 years I've been seeing these items go forward, we name at the university level two or three alternates, mm-hmm. and often one or two of those will have the opportunity, okay. but it's that is an aberration yeah. due to the pandemic.
Okay. Any other comments? May I have a motion to approve item 7E, recommendations for faculty and supported professionals, staff sabbatical leaves for the 2024-25 academic year?
So moved. Second, Wazowitz.
Again, we went through a little bit of discussion. There's any more discussion on the matter? Hearing none, all in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The motion carries. And I want to take a quick second to say, Trustee Moore, thank you for saving me on the, yes, by abstaining on the matter that you should have abstained on. I appreciate that. I missed that in my readings. I would like to invite Interim Executive Vice President and Provost Lori Ilish Piper to present the university reports. Please proceed.
Yes, item 8A. Dr. Natalie Churik is the PwC Professor of Accountancy at Northern Illinois University, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Accounting Education, and the American Accounting Association Vice President for Education. She completed a sabbatical leave in 2020 and will present a brief report of the value of her leave to her research, teaching, and service. Dr. Churik has been awarded multiple research, teaching, and service awards from the university, from the American Accounting Association, and various other professional organizations. She has received grants from the university and several external organizations as well. Her research focuses on education, financial reporting, fraud, ethics, and auditing. She has over 50 publications and has made over 160 presentations, including keynotes and panels in international arenas. She also co-authored 3 John Wiley & Sons published textbooks, including Accounting and Auditing Research, Tools and Strategies, 10th edition. I now invite Dr. Churik to the podium to share her presentation.
Welcome, welcome.
Thank you so much for inviting me to present. Okay. Thank you so much for inviting me to present here at the meeting today. So I'm going to spend a little time talking about me, talking about how my sabbatical actually helped launch my career further. And so I'm excited to be here, and please ask questions. I don't know if I can just figure out how to make this go. Oh, it's going. Okay. All right. Oops. Okay. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. I have a little bit of a timeline on the next slide. And then I'm going to talk about briefly about the missions and values of the respective NIU, College of Business, and the Department of Accountancy. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about my, and that's really far. let me come over here.
There you go.
Yes.
Then
I'll talk about a brief synopsis of my sabbatical and its outcomes, some publications, curricular changes, and global collaborations. And I know what's mostly on the slides, but it's, what is, okay. So I came to NIU in 2001, and I was promoted to a full professor in 2013. I predominantly teach financial reporting at the undergraduate level, which is more like SEC GAAP. And then I also teach graduate research for, I would say, the last decade. It's been my main area. I became the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Accounting Education in 2015, and also I became president, vice president, chair of various American Accounting Association sections and regions, and I was elected to the American Accounting Association board of directors for the next 3 years. So a common theme across NIU, the College of Business and Accountancy, is research, service, teaching, becoming internationally accepted. So it's, oops.
Next slide.
Just say next slide, yeah.
Okay, next slide. Okay, I can do that. I'm looking at next slide. And then there's, okay, got it.
And relax, you're at home, please.
Yes.
This is a very friendly audience, Dr. Church. A very friendly audience.
See, that's what I need, some grounding. Once I get grounding, I'm great. So becoming a nationally recognized leader is really important, and there's also the values that and the measures that go under each of these, but the slide's only so large, so on how to achieve it. Next slide. So I want to briefly talk about the sabbatical itself, but I want to focus more on the impact of the sabbatical and the time for me. So what I was looking at was the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board and their settled disciplinary orders. And what happens is the auditors get audited. If they're a private company, they get an audit peer review standards by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. If they're a publicly traded company, they get audited. The auditors get audited, I should say, by the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. And firms have 1 year to correct deficiencies.
And if they don't correct the deficiencies, they receive a settled disciplinary order from the PCAOB that was created in 2002 as a result of the Enron debacle. So what happens is these pages are somewhere 5 to 20 pages, some 30, 40 pages of violations, which is kind of scary that some auditors are actually committing these types of violations, that many of them. And so, and these are related to accounting standards, financial accounting standards, so audit standards, financial accounting standards, SEC standards, so things like independence and other different actions. And these disciplinary orders talk about the standards, the actions that led to the violations, and the penalty that was received. And so what happens is, how do you analyze that data? They're taxed. So we had to make enormous spreadsheets, and I spent years creating these spreadsheets, a predominant amount of my time in my sabbatical. So next slide, please. You can see that by turning everything into a dichotomous variable, and this is just one example of middle market firms, which be the non-big four, and their violations, the sum of how many violated PCAOB rules, how many violated the SEC Regulation X. So this is what I predominantly did. So, but I really want to spend my time talking about the publications that I worked on during my time in my sabbatical. So next slide, please. And the results of that. So I have specific slides on these, but directly related, I worked on two papers that were published. I have one revised resubmit that's been, it's in the fourth round now. You think eventually it's close to getting accepted. I won a Teaching Learning Curriculum Best Paper Award for one of the papers that I worked on during sabbatical and that was published. Since then, which of course it takes time to create items, I've had two additional publications, two other revised resubmits, six keynote plenary speeches, and eight panels. In curricular, I've made a lot of changes to my classes, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. And I believe that helped me achieve the Illinois CPA Society 2022 Outstanding Educator Award. And you say, well, how can you say that? I can say that because I was nominated for this award before and didn't get it. Right? So I really do think the time and the changes I made helped me improve my classes to help me achieve that great honor. And at that year, I also, in 2021, a year after sabbatical, I received the Teaching Learning Curriculum Hall of Honor Award. That's through the American Accounting Association. Very few people are on there. I think there may be 20 at most at this point over all the years. And because of achieving the Illinois CPA Society Award, I had someone from the AICPA reach out to me and ask me to join a group of global researchers to start studies on teaching excellence. And it was only because of that award that they reached out to me. And the AICPA CIMA wanted to give a grant to these group of people, but they wanted someone else on there. And I was part of that to help them get that grant. And so out of that, so far, we've had five international presentations and a webinar, and one of those presentations received a Best Paper Award this last summer in August. And also, I believe all of that helped me achieve becoming the American Accounting Association Vice President of Education. And how can I say that? I was nominated before and didn't even make the ballot one year. So, and here we go. And I'm also chair of the Accounting Education Committee and also on the Academic Executive Committee through the AICPA and CIMA. Next slide, please. So directly related to the time I spent on my sabbatical, and that was the height of COVID. It was fall of 2020. So good thing I can hand collect my data. But I have one paper with Tim Fogarty from Case Western, Alan Reinstein from Wayne State, related to his peer review, having a midlife crisis, should it? That's in the CPA Journal. And I also worked on a manuscript with Tom Weirich, who's also co-author on one of the textbooks I have. And we were looking at how fair value and SEC accounting and audit enforcement releases, public company accounting oversight board, SDOs, and critical audit matters, how would you introduce that into the curriculum? And how do you get that so faculty can use this real-life information, and of course my sabbatical is about settled disciplinary orders, and so I brought some of that in, and that won a Best Paper Award because you apply in the year that you're published, people nominate your paper for an award. So that did win an award, and that was sponsored by EY. And I also been working on that one case related to revenue recognition, like I mentioned, since that the rules changed in 2018. And so I was working on data before that, and then a case, teaching case, how things have changed because of the change in revenue recognition. And that's in its fourth round now of revised resubmit. I spoke to the editor last month at a presentation that I did for the FARS section, and I said, where is this going? We have one editor, I mean, one reviewer that's kind of been changing his reviews each review, which is kind of unfair, but I think we finally are getting over that. And then my co-authors, Pearson and Wyrick, we had another edition of the book published that year in 2020, and Wiley's asked us to do another edition this summer to get it going for the 11th edition. So since the sabbatical, I've started working with Barbara Apostolou, and this Journal of Accounting Education article is one that is the most highly cited because it summarizes every accounting education publication that there is each year, and I've now become lead author on that article for future years. I've worked, I'm fostering professional research skills in the undergraduate accounting curriculum. That was part of the change that I had done in my undergrad class that I reflected on during the sabbatical. There is also, I was working with some international co-authors from Australia, the Aaron B. International case, and that's actually about, in Hobart, Australia, having an Airbnb and the regulations and rules and sustainability that they need to look at. That got a revised resubmit recently. And peer review and audit quality, should peer review and governmental audits and employee benefit plans continue? Again, this is peer review related to the sabbatical topics, but it's looking more at the governmental peer review audits. And that received a revised resubmit from the CPA Journal. Next slide, please. So I've had multiple plenary keynote speeches. Accounting education, related to accounting education and also research and data collections, and a lot of those were virtual because many of them occurred around the pandemic time, so Moscow and Turkey and also a joint one in Singapore, Mumbai, Dubai, all at the same time, and so weird hours of the night making some of those work. Next slide, please. Invited panels. During the pandemic and during the sabbatical, I was on a panel with some other editors of different journals about accounting education research. And since the sabbatical, I've had a lot of presentations related to research and teaching. And you can read through that list. Next slide, please. So let's talk about the classroom. In the classroom, I've been nominated for awards, so we were good. Accountancy is amazing. Our department is so strong. And so always trying to think about how do we get better. So I had a lot of time to reflect. It was during COVID. I was working on data. And so I was reflecting, saying, well, how can I make things better for my students? And some of that in the graduate class, because directly related to sabbatical, so I'll skip down to the graduate first, where I've always had partners come in, have them go over cases, but I brought in more homework related to settled disciplinary orders and professional ethics and different assignments as such, started introducing the electronic code of federal regulations, which we've always gone to the SEC website. You can get the same information. It's just different places to get that information. And so, and I also prepared, I said, you know what? As a student, I would be terrified presenting to partners, especially a case that was partly written by those partners based on the problems they were having. So I said, how can I help the students feel better about that presentation? And we know that everyone that comes back here loves us, loves our students, and they're back here to give their time. And so that's what I try to explain to them. And then what I did for my undergrads, I said, well, how do I take those cases and bring them into my undergrad classes? Right? And the way I did that was I scaffolded the cases. They wouldn't present to partners because that's too overwhelming for them. but I took the cases and I had them turn in a question every 2 weeks. They turn in one question if there's five questions of the case. Then I'd provide feedback and say, okay, you didn't apply the standard correctly, or you said this was the standard, you didn't bring out the facts. And so I gave them feedback. And so for question two of the case, they were able to adjust it, learn from the process of research, and do better on question two. And again, question two, I gave the feedback. So that's how I changed. And I really think adopting those changes and thinking about it over the sabbatical and how I might change my classes helped me achieve the Illinois CPA Society Award. Because without those changes, the students wouldn't have rated me as high as they did. And you can see some of the undergrad comments up on top was the talking about the scaffolding, and then also the graduate, one of the multiple, they write long things in accountancy. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, the AICPA invited me to join a group of 11 other researchers across the world, five continents. And so far, we've had two grants. We have several other grants outstanding, but these grants were for research assistance. The lead PI is Nadia Gulko from the University of Lincoln in London. So she's been running a lot of those, and we've applied for several other grants. We've had five presentations so far across the world. I helped present in Finland and also at the American Accounting Association in Denver this summer. That paper won a Best Paper Award. So we're looking at teaching excellence, and that's teaching excellence in awards. How do you measure teaching excellence? Are there gender differences in teaching excellence? Are there cultural differences across the world? Like, do some countries value some characteristics better than others? So it's morphed, and there's actually eight different papers that are, so far, and many more in the pipeline. That'll keep me busy for years. So I'm excited about that. Next slide, please. And I think I've come to my time. So I want to say, without the sabbatical, I really wouldn't have had the time to energize. And I've been Northern 2001. It's my second sabbatical. I waited 13 years for my first sabbatical just because I just didn't feel like I, at that point, was ready. Someone had asked a question. When does someone do it for you? No, you as a faculty decide when you're ready to take a sabbatical. And so this is my second sabbatical, and it just helped me a lot, and especially during COVID, we know how hard it was to transition to the electronic, everything virtual, and that really gave me the time to focus on that. So thank you.
I know that some of my colleagues will have some questions for you. You did a great, a fantastic job.
Oh, thank you.
Once we got that clicker thing done,
you were
amazing.
And someone can have their laptop back. Thank you so much, President.
any questions, folks?
When appropriate.
Yeah. Trustee Barsima.
Oh. Thank you, Chair Gales. Thank you very much. Great presentation. I had two questions for you. One, I was curious, one of the speaking engagements you did was entitled How to Develop a Submission and Common Reasons Why Research Publications Are Rejected. I was just curious, what are some of the common reasons that they're rejected? Being a research university, mm-hmm. I'm always curious as to, you know, the research that we do, and I know that, you know, our faculty is outstanding in terms of the publications, but Why are they rejected?
People submit too soon. They submit too early. They haven't had it reviewed by their colleagues. And I've had co-authors that have pushed, oh, let's get it in, because they want to try to get a publication because they need one for some reason, or they want to move on. And anytime you rush, it's not as good of quality paper as it could be. And it gets rejected for that reason. Another major reason is it doesn't meet the guidelines, the mission of the journal. For instance, the one I am editor-in-chief of, and there's only five accounting education journals in the world, so I'm editor-in-chief of one of those, is that it may be related to accounting, but not related to education when they submit. And that doesn't meet the mission because our mission is accounting education. So that's a big reason. They have fatal flaws in their research methodology,
that can happen. They don't talk about the contribution. So what? So those are some of the main reasons why papers get rejected.
Do we keep track within the university of the number of times we make a submission across the campus, not just in the College of Business or Accounting, but do we keep track of the number of times we've made a submission and the number of times they've been rejected?
Individual faculty submit a faculty service report each year, annually, and that is one source of that information. And so that's really most known at the local level, at the department level, and then that's shared up at the college level. We don't necessarily aggregate that information, but we certainly do have that data and could gather that.
Curious as to what our batting average is.
Yeah. And I think it varies depending on discipline. I think it varies depending on the particular journal that you submit to. Some of them are more selective than others.
Yes.
Some of them have incredibly small acceptance rates. And so I think all of that sort of needs to come into consideration. Yeah.
I guess I would add, just for the sake of some of the disciplines where journal articles aren't the currency of expertise, that in the College of Visual and Performing Arts, performances are more important in some areas. Textbook publication or in the humanities, book publication is more important. You've seen scientists like Dr. Shearer present, and he'll say, oh, like, I got a Nature paper. Nature rejects 95% of the papers, but if you don't get your paper there and you get it in a respectable journal. So I think aggregation at the university level is not as informative as our individual faculty in their service reports talking to the disciplinary experts in their department. So things like the questions Dr. Churik just asked, like, was this too early? Do you need additional resources to answer a reviewer question? And then, it's the same reason that, the tenure and promotion decisions really related to excellence in the discipline are lower in the university and the ones with process are higher in the university, so.
Understood. Thanks for coming out, appreciate it. I'm just a little granular here. This is something I did a case study on Airbnb. So I'm kind of curious, what is so different about Airbnb when it comes to international accounting rules and laws? There's a lot of other international firms out there. Why Airbnb? They seem to get picked on quite a bit, so I'm just kind of curious.
But this isn't a bad thing. It's a teaching case to teach students critical thinking. Here, one of the person in the case has a decision to make. They would like to open an Airbnb with some funds, and then there's three options that they have to choose from. One is they can rent out part of it, and their sustainability, and that's big in Tasmania, in Hobart, Tasmania, and there are certain regulations and rules, more so I think in the U.S. U.S., you just say you're going to be an Airbnb and you open up your place, where there you actually have to register. There's a certain number of Airbnbs that they allow, but it's the sustainability aspect of a lot of the international arena compared to the U.S., that where this person is deciding whether or not they should upgrade to these sustainability options and how best to use the money to achieve the highest profits and the best ethical goals. So that it's just a particular case, and I don't know if it's better than a lot of cases, but it did get a revised resubmit, which is really good at a top accounting education journal.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
That you're presenting to them to filter out more information. Where do they play a part in sabbaticals?
That's a really good question. I actually worked with a student on an independent study related to the AICPA and PCAOB differences in the findings against audit firms. And so I was already working in this research, and she needed an independent study, so I had her go that direction. So she had firsthand knowledge of the regulations and rules and violations by firms. And so she was pulled in that way. We had three different GAs help with some of the data collection, but they're not quite at the level they need to be to understand a lot of the information in these disciplinary orders. And I think the students have really benefited in my graduate class because I have them actually go into settled disciplinary orders and pull out findings in those orders, what violations, what type of penalties. So they're actually reading those orders where in the past I had them mostly stick with SEC accounting and audit enforcement releases because everyone finds fraud sexy. And so I would stick with those, which are mostly fraudulent either, although they neither admit nor deny fraud. but I bring them more into the PCOB. So the students are, and I think the scary part is that we all know what independence might be. So I'm just using that as a prime example. You'd be surprised how many firms fail audit independence. And it's like, okay, you can't have any financial interest. But for instance, one firm became an affiliate with BDO, which is a middle market firm just underneath the big four. And they didn't realize when they became an affiliate of BDO that BDO was actually doing the consulting service side and they were doing an audit for this client. And so then it created conflict of interest and an independence problem. Yeah. But what's even scarier is that these settled disciplinary orders don't get issued until 1 year after the firm has an opportunity to correct the deficiency. So these are firms that didn't correct the deficiencies. And that, to me, is mind-boggling.
Yeah.
That you're an auditor and you're not correcting, or you're not even submitting documents to the PCOB. Some people are in violation because they didn't submit requested documents.
Yeah, yeah.
How could you not? Yeah. It just mind-boggling.
I just want to echo, I think, the sentiment of the board here and a deep appreciation for your passion for
yes.
accounting and your work on this. As a head of a federal, former head of a federal financial regulator, who we hired a lot of examiners that examined financial institutions across the U.S., the point that I observed during my decade in D.C. was it all began with quality people and individuals who understood the principles, but also had the courage to step up and address those deficiencies and things. I saw so many times good young people, they were smart, but they didn't take the initiative and the courage to do the right things and push the institutions in our case. So I compliment your work on that and appreciate all the effort you put into making an excellent program here at NIU.
Thank you.
Any more comments?
I couldn't do it without the support of the university, the college, and the department. I mean, they really are supportive of, I wouldn't have achieved what I have without them and you.
Trustee Wadsworth.
Just one point here. The president of BDO is an NIU alum. So Steve Farrar and very, very big supporter of NIU. But I think that's something that goes on quite a bit in the industry between accounting firms and then the mostly software accounting firms, I should say software consulting firms. And that goes on constantly.
You mean the violations or the?
Well, no, just in terms of the people being in the same room dishing business off like that.
Oh, yes.
There's
with multiple. And
a Chinese wall that's there.
I do want to be fair for those that may not understand the role of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board. It may be that the firm actually did something, but if they didn't document that they did it, according to PCOB, they didn't do it. So just because there's a violation doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. It's not a horrible thing. It's just all the firms get it. They try to minimize and do better and come up with better quality control. So they learn as well. So wanted to point that out. But yes, there's.
Okay. Are there any other comments or any other questions from my colleagues? Thank you again.
You
were
so
fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, can we proceed with the university reports?
Yes, item 8B. It presents the annual report on the outcomes of sabbatical leaves that were completed in the 2020-2021 academic year. As noted earlier, the purpose of sabbatical leaves is to maintain and improve the quality of educational programs at Northern Illinois University by creating opportunities for academic and eligible staff to acquire new methods and techniques, to broaden outlooks, to improve professional competency and stature through study, research, and other professional development activities. The item summarizes the outcomes of those leaves, including 121 publications, 93 presentations, 39 grants, 7 artistic works, and more. Overall, 358 works of artistry, scholarship, outreach, and pedagogy were completed by the faculty and staff who were awarded sabbaticals during that time frame. Some truly amazing accomplishments. Item 8C is a presentation by Dr. Carol Sumner, our Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, and our Chief Diversity Officer, and Dr. Clint Michael Renaud, Vice President for Student Affairs. Their presentation is entitled Emerging Hispanic Serving Institution Designation, The Path, Process, and Potential Benefits for NIU. Please welcome Dr. Sumner and Dr. Renaud to the podium for their presentation.
And while we're waiting for them to come to the podium, I just want to note that, as noted in the board item, this presentation is specifically relevant to University Goals 1A, 2A, and 4A.
Good morning. I am excited to be here. This is my first opportunity to greet the trustees in this regard and everyone else that's here. I'm here with my well-esteemed colleague, Dr. Renaud. We are going to provide a presentation for you this morning to give you a little insight. Now, let me say, I did not anticipate we would be following the accounting. And so you see the title is NIU's Formula for Serving This. I do not misrepresent myself to be that that colleague this morning. We are certainly here to give this presentation. Dr. Renaud and I are grateful to have this opportunity to be able to lead in certain ways and provide support across the university. The next slide. We want you to be able to know that we are committed to this work of servingness. As you look at the formula that's here, we wanted you all to have a better understanding of what servingness means, and so we've provided the variables that will contribute to our ultimate success as an institution that is moving from an emerging HSI to a fully designated HSI. We will start with information on the Department of Education, how we go about serving, who we serve, what we do as we serve, and over all of this and why we do this, driving our efforts. Next slide. So servingness is not a definition that requires our students to demonstrate their commitment to the institution. It is our commitment to demonstrating our commitment to our students. But you have to first be an eligible institution with the right criteria that the Department of Education will then recognize the institution. So we've provided you with some of the basic information as to what it means to be an eligible institution. First, as defined eligible, I will go into that on the next slide, but it requires a 25% undergraduate full-time population of Hispanic or Latino students. But the other criteria help us further understand the students and those who will benefit from this institutional designation. Next slide. As you think about eligible institution, I'm not wearing my glasses, but I know what this criteria is. You all have it on your PowerPoint slide. There are two criteria that establish a broader context for who serve. Either your student population, 50% required to have received financial aid, that is particular financial resources or support, or you have a percentage of your students who receive Pell-eligible funding. And so we have those numbers if you need them. The additional criteria of eligible is what broadens the scope beyond and says, first off, this is about access to the institution. Then you have the cost of attendance. So when you look at this graphic and you understand eligibility is your first criteria, number of Hispanic and Latino students, cost of attendance, that helps us understand what the Department of Ed requires. Next slide. So who are the people we serve? I think these are photos. I went through thousands of photos, my dear colleague and I, and I think the first impression is that everyone here, through all of the means, those are the individuals that are supported primarily and only. It may often be perceived that it is a designation that only serves Hispanic or Latino students. These are truly the students that make up the largest population of our undergraduate population. I would, however, offer this. Next slide. They are not the only students that we serve. Every student on campus will benefit from this designation. The students you see here represent many populations, and if you looked at these individuals, you would not be able to determine who is a first gen, who is a low income, who is a student from a rural population, who is receiving a particular kind of aid. It is all students will benefit from this designation. Next slide. And when you think about it, it's what we do to serve. And so you will see many different representations of how we go about doing what we do to demonstrate our servingness. From the De La Vega Center that is now in its second call for a competition to our most recent visit from the Chancellor for the City Colleges of Chicago. Next slide. One of the things that is important to realize is that the institution didn't just start working on this for a designation. These are priorities that have been well established by Northern Illinois University through our goals, through our vision, through university goals, and through the SEM 2.0, which is led by several of us here at the institution. As you move forward into the next slide, you will see that there are criteria. Again, small writing. You all have it on your PowerPoint slides there. But they're all the things we're committed to. Institutional goal and mission, graduation rates, how we go about demonstrating a commitment to students and their service. I will now have our colleague come forward as he will provide additional context.
So again, what we understand is that we have, educational researcher and sociologist Dr. Brené Brown says, who we are is how we lead. And this is who Northern Illinois University is. This is who we are. This is who our students are. And this is how we lead. And so guided by, when we work on our servingness approach, we can be guided by the Excellency in Education Foundation, which is a Latina-led organization that provides some really solid anchors and some examples and a learning community that provides us with opportunities to engage in really best practice work that institutions are doing around this country to help a serving intentionality with serving for all. We also know that, next slide please. We also know that when you think about this designation and providing the, we see the students that it serves, we are aware of how the direct reflection of our university goals, and again, I just want to remind us specifically with our shared leadership, our increased enrollment and student success and the engagement efforts, and our shared equity leadership to drive equitable outcomes, processes, and advance inclusive campus. This, everything about those goals speaks to this work, and it's work that has been done again and again and again with a really solid foundation on this campus. Next slide, please. Next one, please. And so when you think about how the benefits land on a college campus and how the benefits will land on this campus, HSIs often receive federal funding and grants such as the Title V program, and with that from the Department of Education can be used to enhance educational programs or support services, things around improving institutional facilities. This funding often leads to more scholarships. It can help reduce tuition costs and enhance financial aid packages for our students. Also, when an institution has an HSI designation, and use federal and other funding sources to develop improved academic programs, particularly those in our STEM fields. So we know our science, technology, engineering, mathematics programs. These often lead to more accessible programs. These often lead to more to attract a more relevant and diverse student body, which we know potentially leads to better educational outcomes for all the students these programs serve. HSIs often provide comprehensive support services tailored to meet needs of Hispanic students
and students that we are serving at this institution are rural students, first-generation students, students from low socioeconomic backgrounds, students who have historically been pressed furthest into the margins. And these efforts, these support services, whether it's tutoring, mentoring, counseling services, career counseling, these programs are designed to really think about the intentionality of that to help the academic support, the sense of belonging, and how we help students succeed in their college journey. The other piece around an HSI designation that will support and help NIU is that we are likely to, you know, HSIs are likely to foster a more inclusive campus culture. And again, this goes back to thinking around a sense of belonging, helping with the engagement and understanding that this is where I'm, this is home, this is where I can thrive. Not just survive, but thrive. And so when we think about the values and diversity and the multicultural perspectives that HSI designations and institutions represent, this includes culturally relevant curriculum. This includes things like diverse faculty, multicultural events, clubs and organizations that celebrate cultures and differences. And so again, this is nothing new to us. This really is nothing new to us. But this designation enhances the support that we can offer and enhances the access and equity opportunities for all students. And so this is something really to get excited about. So thank you if you have any questions.
We're going to close with the last slide, which is our why. The impact is not just about the students. It's about the families and the communities that are changed, because a designation recognized it's not where you come from, it's where you're going. Absolutely. And that we are here to serve in the in-between. Thank you.
And President Freeman often always says to, through, and beyond, right? Getting students to, through, and beyond college. And so that right there, when you think about our why, that's the perfect quote for that, how to get them to, through, and beyond.
Let me say this. You guys had a tough act to follow, but you did a great job. I noticed, and I'll be the one to kick off some of our questions. Certainly. For you, but I noticed on the presentation you talked about expanded services in,
yes,
one of those.
Yes.
And I was wondering, what effect has this designation had on the overall culture of the campus? Are there, do we have to add new programs in light of the fact that we have a Hispanic culture that we may not have been really addressing some of their issues in the past? And then what effect has that had actually on the staff itself? Are we seeing increases in Hispanic instruction or instructors?
Well, the beautiful thing about who we are is that we've already had those programs. So it allows us to increase and expand how we have leveraged those. You have the Center for Latino Studies. You have the Latino Resource Center. Certainly those are there. But just recently, again, in the photographs, you'll see the De La Vega Center, which has been created. The students that benefit from those kinds of opportunities, going out into the field and doing research and scholarship, yes, having opportunities to engage, the students are certainly impacted. We are also looking at ways that we're expanding for parents and families. Good. So we have a day that we're looking at where Bienvenidos a NAU is a program that we're working at with SOL and enrollment management and recruitment so that we can welcome families. We recognize the cultural shift.
Yes.
Typically groups, when you see mass, it's between 25% and 40% when they start impacting the culture of organizations and communities, and that's where we are. So it is not that it's been ignored. It's recognizing that the threshold we are now upon, when you look at the demographics of the institution across every demographic group, we are majority minoritized except for the College of Law, which is at 51%. Every other percentage of white enrolled student is at 48 or 49%. So we recognize the impact more broadly is in recognizing how those students are coming in. So tutoring services, yes. Culturally relevant pedagogy, yes. Summer bridge experiences, yes. Faculty development, it's for every person at the institution.
Very good, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Trustee Wildswood.
Yes, thank you for the presentation, appreciate it. I'm curious, as far as, so we get our designation in 2025?
Yes, on this. So IPED's data is not current. IPED's data is 2 years behind. So what we will be looking at is in February of 2025, I'll start here. In the fall, we finally reached the 25% threshold for Hispanic and Latino students. They take the count in the fall. So in 23, fall of 23, we reached that threshold. In February of 25, we should be at that point designated as a Hispanic serving institution because we've already met the eligibility criteria. Here's the trick. You got to maintain the 25%.
Yeah, okay.
So this is why we talk about it not just as a recruitment, but as a retention mechanism as we're driving better understanding of the impact.
So with that said, how many other, so there's 12 state universities, of the other 12 state universities, how many have this designation?
It's a much larger context because we have, I think there are three institutions, is that correct? It's UIC.
UIC, NEIU, and Governor State.
Three others. We are the fourth state. There are several across the state that are designated as HSIs.
Several private institutions.
Private, okay. And then community colleges as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure.
Trustee Herrera.
Go ahead.
And then I'll get you, John.
Thank you for the presentation. You know, I can also attest to the fact that we have been preparing for this for a long time since I started as a board member. We have been talking about, like, we are and very soon will be, right, in HSI and really just embracing that and starting to lay the groundwork for this. So I'm excited that we're here, right, and we truly are here, and it's not unexpected, right, and it's fully embraced. And I appreciate the comments about family. I was able to attend, and I haven't attended for a while, the Latino graduation.
We can get you the date.
Yes, I would love to. And it was just very special, and just with the families engaged, so I appreciate all of that, too. My question is, one thing that we can do really well, but then where we, just institutions of higher ed fall short, we can do really well in the programming and the connections and making sure the frontline staff, the student-facing staff, is diverse. But where we often fail, and it's because for lots of reasons, right, is that we don't have that representation in leadership, faculty, college leadership. Is the hardest thing because you have to develop a pipeline for it, obviously. But also so important to the students we serve. So what does that strategy look like? How are you thinking about that, of how we diversify sort of the higher levels of leadership?
Well, thank you for the question. We, and thank you all for your questions. We have really been intentional. President Freeman, I think, has been providing the kind of leadership that says we should be doing more to increase the representation of diverse individuals, faculty, staff, and administration. That is not a new call. I think each of us now being able to recognize, even working with John Arcado in HR and the ways that we are understanding how people bring skill sets to the institution and that we're not structured in such a way that we can't recognize the value of what individuals bring. We have a new colleague, Jade Silva-Tovar. I've asked her to join us. She has been working with ADEI as a representative there, with Myra, with Nicole Knudsen, with Clint Michael and his team to look at how are we looking at retention efforts. But then we're also looking at graduate student experiences. How are we facilitating a pipeline to build and develop our own? We work with Yvonne in terms of the READ program. How are we looking at opportunities to support faculty and staff in that way? We continue. We're still working with the SEM 2.0 group across multiple facets of the institution. Christina Abreu is one of the leaders in working with our HSI working group. That group is right now looking at how are we representing the institution across, again, populations. So very intentional in recruiting faculty. Yes, President.
I think that's such an important question, yeah. Trustee Herrera, and you gave a very complete answer, Carol.
Yeah.
But one thing I'd also like to highlight is when you're talking about the faculty personnel process, when you're talking about that pipeline, not only the recruitment of those faculty, but the retention of those faculty, the policies and administrative procedures that enable them to succeed or that pose barriers to them, the community building and culture, academic affairs and the office of the executive vice president and provost is very, very important. We have a faculty mentoring program that Dr. Janice Hamlet has developed that intersects with the statewide effort. And I want to just call out our vice provost for faculty affairs, Barbara Gonzalez, who's here, because she's spending a lot of time on faculty development issues as a partner to human resources, because the way we recruit faculty is different and more decentralized in many cases than the way we recruit staff. And we're having intentional conversations about how we can do better. Mm-hmm. We're looking at national effective practices and benchmarks at institutions that share our context. And so I think this is, you know, definitely something we can present on in more detail later, but I really appreciate the question. And I just wanted to make sure that the partnership of academic affairs in the personnel process was appropriately acknowledged. And I want to say that in addition to the provost's office, shared governance is a very important partner here. And our faculty senate and the committees of faculty senate are very aware of the role that they can play in being change agents on our campus to make the campus more inclusive, and they are knocking that out of the park as well. So shout out to Faculty Senate.
Very good.
Thank you.
I don't think we have any more comments, but I'd like to leave you with this. Oh, we'll do John, forgive me. And then we have one more after that as well. Forgive me.
I just have I'm trying to understand the core expenses per FTE requirement.
Sure.
And I just as a general, I'm just struggling to sort of track what it is.
Okay. They outline the core FTE as the expenses. The threshold for that cost, I believe, is $34,367 or something like that. As long as our costs every year, there's a matrix on the Department of Education website that outlines what their expected costs are. Again, they are looking across institutions that are very similar. The category is 4-year public institution. The other category would be a 4-year private and then a 2-year. And so that's the threshold for the cost. And they give you all of the variables.
So we're
it
not
cannot be above.
We're not compared to a private institution.
No, we are compared to 4-year public institutions.
And this is our cost to provide full-time education for these students.
As with all federal definitions, there are very specific parameters that go into the calculation. I don't know if the board remembers this, but during the pandemic, there were Title III funds that were available to institutions under the Strengthening Institutional Program. So you didn't have to be a designated MSI or HSI, but you had to meet the core expenses criteria. And AQUITER made sure that we were aware of the program, did the calculation, we met the criteria at the time, we were able to get additional funds. Each time you apply for a grant like that, you have to look at the current timeline and parameters, but it's the kind of thing that our institutional research and sponsored projects people will work on together to make sure that as definitions shift or conditions at the university shift. So like it's not like walk-around knowledge is that we serve students who are very consistent with the other institutions who are 4-year publics that get these grants. Expertise is like, I know which number to plug in where, how to interpret this definition, and make sure that that criteria moves forward. Does that help?
What is the... Sorry. It helps. It helps, but I'm looking for the... what are they looking for with that number? Like, what are they hoping to exclude, and who are they hoping to include?
It's a technical calculation that is hoping to include the students who will benefit most from the programs, the funding, the servingness. It's looking to exclude institutions that might meet the enrollment criteria on a shared ancestry, racial, or ethnic basis, but really be serving students who are not marginalized by their first-generation service, their socioeconomic status, et cetera. As more and more institutions become Hispanic-serving institutions, we fully expect, as a higher ed community, to see additional assurance of your ability to serve students to be incorporated into eligibility. And so one of the reasons we're very excited about the opportunity to partner with Excellencia in Education, who is such a national resource on this, is I think earning that type of seal of approval, being able to show that we meet a national set of criteria for institutions that are excellent in this regard, is going to become more and more important, and things from those criteria are likely to be incorporated into grant eligibility requirements going forward. We're well positioned for that shift. So we look forward to it. And I know Trustee Herrera is very familiar with Excellencia because Wilbur Wright just won an award, one of the city colleges, for their excellent program. And so did Daly. And we are actually, I think on one of the slides you saw in the parentheses, you know, there's HACU, there's Excellencia, but the Illinois HSIs are very excited about working together to support one another. And some of the national organizations think Illinois could be a model for the rest of the country because of the diversity of our state population. And because I have the mic, I'm going to just say one more thing. You know, when we talk about who benefits from this designation, I want to be clear that all of our students benefit. We should be very proud of the fact that in contrast to some of the other HSIs in the state, the demographics of our student body mirror those of the Northern Illinois region. And when you ask students why they come to NIU and you ask faculty why they choose to come to NIU, they mention the diversity of our campus and its welcoming environment as a reason to come here. When you ask employers why they hire our students, our employers want to hire people who understand how to live, work, and learn together. And so the resources that we have on our campus aren't about serving and siloing the individual student populations. It's about making sure that people understand each other, can see the common humanity. And so every single student who comes to our campus, regardless of their individual social, racial, ethnic identity, is going to benefit from the services we get from being an HSI.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I'm going to call on Dennis Barsamen in a second here, but I want to say thank you for that statement.
Yeah.
And thank you for your, I think Eve Clinton, you even said during the course of your presentation about this is a program that benefits everybody. And, you know, I come from the Chicago area. Oftentimes, brown and black are pitted against one another for the most craziest reasons.
Right.
And I appreciate it so much when you put that slide up about the benefits for the campus. If people stop and listen to that, they won't be offended, they won't be put off, and I think it will be viewed as a welcoming institution for all races to come to school here.
Absolutely.
But I want to call on Dennis Person.
Yeah, I just have a real quick question, and if it's already been covered and I missed it, I apologize. In terms of tracking the 25%, I assume that the students self-identify on the application when they apply to NIU, is that correct?
They do. And part of what we understand in working with other groups and communities is we must continue to encourage that students see the benefit in selecting and providing that information, that it is not being used in a problematic way, but actually a way to better serve our campus and community without it being viewed as a negative or derogatory recognition. Absolutely. And just to share the two of the pictures that we put up, one was a picture of SHIP, students, Hispanic engineering group. The other was NSBE. Because it's important to be able to say that both groups are participants in engineering, and they will all benefit from the HSI designation.
And doing amazing things.
Amazing.
National conferences, awards,
right.
You know.
Right. So,
I think Trustee Herrera had one other question.
I just have a question on data. When you mentioned, you know, you're making sure that students understand the value of identifying, if that is how they identify. You know, one thing we're seeing in higher ed is, and just because the fabric of our country is changing too, that more students are choosing multiracial.
Yes.
They're not identifying. How are we handling that?
I do think, so Greg Barker has been a wonderful colleague in collecting data on data on data, and I think that it's been a process many of us are looking at in terms of how we message, yeah, what it means to be a part of certain communities, and then how we gather that data to demonstrate things across the institution, like a climate survey, or the students that might be a part of the NESE, which is National Survey for Student Engagement, other ways that we're engaging. We provide many opportunities for students to see why their feedback and information is important, but it's also being able to create visibility, particularly as we're thinking about Hispanic or Latino, because our reflection of multiracial can also be individuals who are multiracial, but we don't have, a sense that they even understand why it matters. So it's an ongoing education to help people know why it is important to be seen and not invisible. I don't know if that helps. I'm looking at President Freeman if that seems to be, okay, very good. But we recognize the importance of being able to say, for faculty and staff as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why we want to have this information, and not because we're using it to count it against, yeah, someone, but it better allows us to serve our campus constituents. So, yeah.
I think this is a good opportunity for me to say that Ancestry says I have 1% Mexican.
Yeah.
1%, but I'm hanging in.
It's significant. So thank you all. We appreciate the
very
time.
Good, very good. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you. I think that ends it for us. Are there any other matters to come before the committee? Well, let me share this with you. The next meeting date for the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee will be on May the 9th, 2024. At that meeting and moving forward thereafter, John Butler will serve as the chair of this committee, along with Eric Wadsowitz, who will serve as its vice chair. All other committee positions will remain the same. With that said, may I have a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Wadsowitz.
Is there a second?
Second, Herrera.
Ms. Hannon, will you please take a roll call vote?
Trustee Rita Athes.
Yes.
Trustee Dennis Barsima.
Yes.
Vice Chair John Butler.
Yes.
Board Chair Montel Gales.
Yes.
Trustee Veronica Herrera.
Yes.
Trustee Tim Moore.
Yes.
Trustee Leland Strom.
Yes.
Trustee Eric Wadsowitz.
Yes.
Okay, that's stated and motions passed. This concludes the Academic Affairs, Student Affairs, and Personnel Committee meeting. We will reconvene the Research and Innovation, Legal, and Legislative Affairs Committee.
10:10.
At 10:10. Thank you very much.